From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how much influence do special interest groups have on the bills that lead to laws in Michigan?
It's very difficult for any one particular actor in the American political system to have a lot of influence on their own over anything in particular.
On this Thanksgiving Day Eve, we look back at Detroit's historic parade.
When you go through the photos over the years, doesn't matter, you see that look of awe on all these children's faces.
Plus, food historian Bill Loomis reconstructs the Thanksgiving Day feast from 1850. They didn't stop at turkey.
I mean, it was amazing how much food they put out back then. It was just beef and mutton and ducks. It was just a huge feast.
Those stories and more on today's Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Thanksgiving Eve, it's all about the food. We'll talk to a food historian about what you might have found on your plate here in Michigan 150 years ago on Thanksgiving Day. Think lots of oysters and roast bear. But first on today's show, let's think back to when we were sitting in our desks in school learning about the way our government works. Did anyone ever come away with the idea that some of that might involve lobbyists and special interest groups putting pre-written, ready-made bills into the hands of lawmakers? It's called manufactured legislation. Perhaps this practice is a routine part of doing business at the Capitol. Perhaps it's a case of handing over the keys to non-elected groups and individuals, allowing them to be a part of crafting legislation. Michael Heaney is Assistant Professor of Organizational Studies and Political Science at the University of Michigan. Michael, explain to us, what is happening here with these pre-written bills?
Well, as you know, there are thousands of interest groups in the United States that are advocating a wide number of causes. Some of these groups choose to concentrate part of their agenda on the state level. And part of the way that they may do that is by crafting model legislation and having their affiliates at the state level push that legislation and try to get different states to adopt it.
Is it saying to a lawmaker, here's our idea of what would make a great bill. How about it?
Well, that's exactly what interest groups are all about. Interest groups have got their agendas, the things they stand for. Some of those things we would think are good. Some of those things we would think are bad. They have a list of things that they want to try to accomplish. And so they bring these ideas to legislatures. And if they're doing it at the national level, it tends not to be so much in this kind of model legislation format because they more bring their agenda and then they try to work it into something that's already moving. If you're looking at state level, you know, maybe what they want to do is try to get a particular law passed in 10 or 15 states. And so they have this legislation that they're saying, well, you know, we think this is a really good idea. And then they have their lobbyists at the state level try and sell that to legislators and convince them that it's a good idea.
And everybody knows there are certainly lobbyists, there are certainly groups everywhere advancing their points of view, as you explain. Does this cross a line, in your view, from urging or presenting to actually formulating policy? Is this usurping power?
Well, that's a great question. And you could say, how much influence do interest groups have? Some people say that they have too much influence. Some people say that they don't have very much. I guess what I would say is it's very difficult for any one particular actor in the American political system to have a lot of influence on their own. And the reason for that is that American politics is structured around multiple veto points. You have different branches of the legislature, you have the executive, you have the courts, and you have all sorts of interested parties, not just interest groups, but also the media, nonprofit organizations, and so on. And so I don't think that this particularly crosses a line. Sometimes this is a very effective tactic. Most of the time, it results in nothing. So most model legislation that's proposed goes absolutely nowhere.
But it could happen, couldn't it?
Sometimes it definitely is successful.
So it could be a case of something that has been crafted and drafted by a group that gets to the right lawmaker that could wind up with little change?
That's definitely possible. And, you know, that really has to do with the legislator in particular. How much time do they have? What's on their agenda? What do they want to try to accomplish? How does this particular piece of legislation, how does it serve their interests or the interests of their constituents? It may be that a particular lawmaker really cares about this issue. It's one they've thought a lot about. And it just so happens that there's this other group that's going to come along and is going to help them promote that issue that they wanted to promote anyway. And part of the reason why they use groups is they have very limited time, and they also have relatively limited staff given the enormity of the issues that they work on. I actually spent a year, I had a fellowship working for Congress. I worked for the U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce. And we were always talking to interest groups on both sides, people who were our friends, people who were not our friends. And people who are our friends, we turned to them and got information from them and tried to use that information the best that we could to try to help our agenda. Now, of course, if they didn't give us information, if we didn't like the information they gave us, if we thought it was wrong, if we thought it was biased, we discarded it. But it was very helpful to have their thoughts on what we should be doing.
So as a voter listening, someone listening now, or you as a voter, or me as a voter, do we feel that this trend of having these pre-produced bills, I know I saw one place where it was called a corporate bill mill, maybe that's extreme and maybe not. Is that something that is concerning to you? What do you think about this?
Well, I don't think it's that there's a trend of having more prepackaged bills. I think that these have been around for a very long time. For example, Justice Louis Brandeis at the turn of the 20th century talked about the idea of laboratories of democracy, the idea that policies could be tried out in different states and different places, and the states copied one another and used the same kind of legislation in different places. And he said this was an advantage of the federal system. I think that part of the reason that you asked me to be on here today is because ALEC is an organization that has been very effective at doing this. So I think the problem, if there is a problem there, is not necessarily that there's an interest group that's pushing model legislation. I think perhaps you could say the problem is the media system or other aspects of the political system that are not fully critical of the kinds of information that they're being presented, or that it's in some way, if you look at the substance of some of what their agenda is, you might say, well, why is it these types of bills are being promoted in the legislature? So I think the fact that an organization like ALEC is promoting those bills is not necessarily a bad thing. I think that the fact that state legislators in many places may be so eager to promote this agenda, that may be a problem.
And ALEC, we should say, for those who haven't heard of ALEC, is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it's interesting, a lot of big companies, GM and Walgreens and Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Amgen and many more, have been cutting their funding quite a bit in recent months. Now, we know ALEC represents the conservative side. Mm-hmm. But there are groups really on all sides circling the wagons, aren't there, from every possible viewpoint offering up model bills?
Well, I would say it's definitely there are groups on both sides that do this. I wouldn't say it's every possible viewpoint. Only some interest groups use this kind of tactic. So, I mean, there's lots of different tactics that interest groups can use to sort of push their agendas. Some of them do rallies and demonstrations. Others of them really concentrate on campaign finance. Some of them concentrate on the sort of nitty-gritty shoe leather lobbying. You know, model legislation is one of a wide variety of tactics, and only some use it. But I think you've seen these kind of tactics, for example, used widely by labor unions. You've seen them used by professional associations that are trying to promote particular kinds of standards for their profession. They're used for citizens groups that are trying to promote citizens' rights in different areas. There are all sorts of groups that use this kind of model legislation. I think what's distinctive about ALEC is that in recent years, they've been more successful at it than some other groups have been. And part of the reason for that is it's very difficult for any one particular interest to be very successful in the American system.
How transparent do you think this all is, the model legislation, to the
public? Well, the legislative process is not very transparent, right? So there's lots of different sources of information that legislators draw upon. They have private meetings with all sorts of people. You know, we don't see any of that. In general, politicians are people that work very hard. They take meetings with lots of different kinds of people across their constituencies. And every one of those people is trying to influence them in some way. And some are successful in influencing them and some aren't. And we have very little insight into how this happens. And the American legislature in general, both in the Capitol, Washington, D.C., and also in the states, is designed to be penetrated by many different kinds of interests. That's the reason why we have so many different representatives.
Yes.
Representatives are people, they know people from across the board in society. They know people who are involved in schools, people who are involved in business. unions, entertainment, sports. They know everybody because everybody is trying to get the attention of their legislators and trying to get their legislators to try to do their bidding. And so it's very difficult to have a sense of who's doing that and who's not doing that. Sometimes it does become a little bit more transparent, right? So if an organization like ALEC starts promoting model legislation and you start seeing that legislation adopted in lots of different states, then you say, ah, you know, obviously ALEC's hand is behind this. But most of the time, it's very difficult to see this kind of influence and how it really unfolds.
Is it something that you believe anyone who's considering running for state office needs to be aware of and should not allow themselves to take a sample bill or a model bill and say, that looks good, and turn it on? It needs...
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Right.
I mean, I think that people who are elected representatives are given a wide range of responsibilities. I mean, they have to legislate about anything that could need legislation, right, which requires much broader expertise than anyone has. And they have to draw upon information that's brought to them by their constituencies of different types. And they have to look at that information and they have to critically evaluate that information the best they can. Sometimes that critical evaluation may be take the bill that's being promoted by the Society of Nurse Anesthetists and put that bill into law. You know, the nurse anesthetists have got a great idea. We should do exactly what they're suggesting. Let's do it. That may be the best thing for them to do in some cases. I mean, although I think that they are responsible for weighing the interests and thinking, who am I really representing by doing this? If you take all of your legislation from labor or you take all of your legislation from Fortune 500 companies, then you're probably not doing a good job of representing your real constituents who are broader than any one of those groups. So legislators have got to think about who they're getting information from, and they've got to try to balance that information and make sure that they're hearing from groups that represent as many different people as possible. But sometimes the best thing to do is to take the information that you get from a particular group, if you trust them, and use that information straight up.
Thank you for coming in and sharing your expertise and kind of shedding some light on this whole model legislation question that we had. And we look forward to talking with you more in the future. Dr. Michael Heaney, University of Michigan Assistant Professor of Organizational Studies and Political Science.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Still to come, some slightly odd Thanksgiving foods from yesteryear, and we'll take a look at the history of Detroit's Thanksgiving Day Parade. That's in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Thanksgiving Eve, chances are pretty good you're doing all that prep for tomorrow's big feast. And in doing so, you're following a tradition that dates back for hundreds of years. So if your great-great-grandma came for Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow at your house, would she feel at home with what you'd be serving? We're going to find out now as we turn to writer Bill Loomis, who's author of Detroit's Delectable Past, 2 centuries of Frog Legs, Pigeon Pie, and Drugstore Whiskey. Welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Cindy.
So would great-great-grandma feel at home with our 2012 dinners?
You know, of all our holidays, I'm confident that she would. She might be a little bit amazed at the size of our turkeys, which are probably 3 times as big as hers were, but generally it hasn't changed very much.
Well, we know Thanksgiving got its start in New England some 400 years ago, and then
mm-hmm.
it became kind of that Puritan thing. They had the days of Thanksgiving and the days of fasting.
That's
how very English Reformation.
Yeah, exactly.
But here we were, French Detroit. So how did it make its way and when?
Yeah, the French in French Detroit, prior to the New Englanders coming to Detroit in the 1820s through the 1840s, they didn't have Thanksgiving. They had Christmas, of course, which New England didn't have, but they did have, but they didn't have Thanksgiving. So it was Lewis Cass who was originally from New Hampshire, who really pushed it through and made the first proclamation in 1824 to celebrate Thanksgiving.
Did it catch on pretty quickly? Was everybody in the mood for a good party?
It was slow. Prior to the Civil War, it was as much, if not more so, a religious holiday. So it was a day of kind of like the Sabbath, where people would take a day off work and relax and that sort of thing. But they did do turkey, and they did have relatives over, but it was a little bit slower, I think.
So would we in 2012 enjoy eating the turkey of French Detroit? I know you've dug up the quote. What is it? Too much for one, not enough for two?
Yeah, that was the expression at some of the parties, because the turkeys were, you know, about 8 pounds. And if you think, if you go to Myers and you buy a chicken, it's about 5 pounds, you know. So it wasn't much bigger than that. So you can't feed a whole table load of people on 1 8-pound turkey.
None of these butterball behemoths.
No.
No,
they didn't do that. They were usually wild turkeys. And wild turkeys are lean and mean, and they don't, you know, they don't get real heavy. So
would the meat have tasted pretty much like what we expect?
Yeah, pretty much. But it was always described as a little gamier. But people liked that. You know, they liked wild game a lot, so that was preferred.
So if you would either have to do a lot more turkeys if you had a large family, or you'd start rounding your table out with other food.
That's what they did. That's exactly right.
So what kinds of things would we see served? Let's say it's 1859, it's Thanksgiving. What would we be having if we were in Michigan at Thanksgiving?
Well, if you had your family over, and it was tradition to bring your family over, you would have – the turkey was always talked about, but there would also be chickens. There might be ducks. Ducks were very commonly served. Wild game was very popular. So they might have venison. They might have fish, quail, even squirrel. And one Thanksgiving table had squirrel. There was much more variety. And they would serve traditionally pies, meat pies, things like that. So the table was full, and everybody had a, you know, depending on how big the table was, how many people over, you'd have a bigger variety of things.
And the way they were cooking, it was, was it in the fire, the hearth?
Yeah, it started in the hearth. The stoves didn't come around until a little after the Civil War. So people did, the women, did the cooking on the hearth. And they would, in the French days, they had a cord which they suspended the turkey from, and they would basically turn it and baste it. The other methods, they used a tin kitchen, which was a sort of a metal oven that you would push up against the fire, and the turkey would be inside that. But you had to put it on a spit, which wasn't easy. It had to be turned. So that was constant attention along with being basted.
Something that the younger child could stand and turn the turkey on the spit.
Yeah, that was somebody's job.
While mama was working.
Yeah, really, making 100 other things.
Well, when you mention wild game, Bill Loomis, you brought up something in some of your research that made me turn my head twice and go, what? What would they eat?
Right. A popular item for some big families was bear. They would have roast bear as part of the Thanksgiving dinner. And imagine the surprise on your family's face if you brought out a 300-pound roast bear for Thanksgiving. But that was – it supposedly tasted like beef. Yeah, that was a big item.
What kind of shopping how would they go shopping for that? I mean, we're all pretty used to going in and picking a pre-wrapped cold thing
frozen
out of
turkey.
Frozen or it's a big deal to buy it fresh. But a little bit more close to the earth, wasn't it?
Yeah, they bought live turkeys. The turkeys were at the market. Mm-hmm. Usually, actually, they were in front of the market on the street. And you would go and basically check out. They had rules of thumb in the newspaper articles or in the magazines on how to pick a live bird and not get stuck with a bad bird. You had to check the turkey's eyes and check its feet, and they would check all kinds of little tips on how to make sure the bird was freshly killed. It was important that it had to be freshly killed and that you got a plump bird that wasn't going to be bad for your family.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with writer Bill Loomis, who is really a food historian and has dug into the past in Michigan to find out what we might have been eating for Thanksgiving, our big feast, through the ages in Michigan. Now, you found out there was quite a love affair with oysters.
Oysters became really popular in the middle 19th century. The oyster companies just went crazy with marketing and shipping oysters. They would load wagons with oysters. They actually came up with a technique to ship oysters and keep them fresh. So they once they learned that, they could ship them all over the country, and they did. Before even trains, they were shipping these oysters to the point where people on the prairies would have oysters, baked oysters twice a week, and they'd never been within 1,000 miles at least of the ocean, but they had oysters.
Wow. So what kinds of ways would oysters show up on the Thanksgiving table?
The most popular way was either in the stuffing. The oyster stuffing was really popular, and that was either chopped with mushrooms and other things or put in whole, or in something called oyster pie. And oyster pie was like, if you can imagine, a big chicken pot pie mm-hmm. with oysters, butter, and milk, and salt and pepper, and some spices, and a crust, and they would bake that. Later, in the 1860s and 70s, scalloped oysters were more popular because it was bigger even than that. So people just couldn't get enough of them.
We kind of – that has waned, I think.
I know. Yeah, oysters on Thanksgiving. And oyster sauce was also popular, which was like a gravy, boiled oysters, and you'd pour it over your turkey. People had a lot more variety than we do, too, in the way they made turkey. Now we just basically roast it, mm-hmm. or I guess some people deep fry it.
Right.
But then boiled turkey was very popular. Yeah, I know.
I'm not feeling a lot of flavor. I'm not feeling
no,
butter.
No, it was really it wasn't really boiled. It was actually poached, but they called it boiled. Hmm. But they put it in a big kettle, and sometimes their stoves just wouldn't work well, or the fire wasn't right, or something that didn't lend itself to roasting. So you had to have a little more creativity. So they would boil it, poach it, if you will, mm-hmm. with onions and celery and butter in the water, cloves. Sometimes they would add, and then oyster dressing and oyster stuffing was very popular with boiled turkey.
Well, there we go. Keep that one in mind.
Yeah, you want to put that on your
list.
What
about side dishes?
Side dishes were a lot of the same side dishes that we have now. They served squash, served onion dishes were popular.
Creamed onions or things like that?
Creamed onion. Okay. Root vegetables, very popular. Turnips. They had things called turnip macaroni, which was basically turnips cut into thin strips and boiled. And pickles were very popular. In fact, also served with turkey, I want to mention that, tongue and ham was a popular side dish with turkey.
How very deli of them.
I know.
But you know what? If that goes back, and I know just based on having had a Christmas dinner in Ireland, spiced beef,
mm-hmm.
which I've never seen over here ever, but it was very, very cloves and
mm-hmm.
cinnamon.
Right,
spiced
right.
beef would be part of mm-hmm. the turkey, and it would be in Ireland, it was potato stuffing. My mother-in-law's potato stuffing.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But I just wonder if some of that came.
Well, yeah, we had mince pies, which is basically chopped up meat spiced with, just like you say, clove, cinnamon, all kinds of things. In Detroit, they had a traditional mince pie called a tortilla. That was basically a mince pie with a crust on top.
Now, in all of your research, you dug up a story from a Detroit newspaper from woman's writer Marion Hale.
Oh, yeah.
Who described what – so she was the Martha Stewart of her
mm-hmm.
day, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
The ideal Thanksgiving dinner for the 1850s. So – and when I read that – we think we overeat?
Right. I mean, it was amazing how much food they put out back then. It was just beef and mutton and ducks and all this on these tables, just huge. And that was the idealized. She was a very famous person, actually, during her day. And she was a leading editor of her day. So she was really like a Martha Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
She just recommended just – it was just a huge feast, kind of like a Roman feast almost.
So it would run for several hours?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It would go 4 hours. And you just keep eating and bringing out more stuff. And it was quite a scene.
And what would be served to drink with the big feast?
They served wine. You know, they would have wine and beer, cider, nothing very alcoholic.
Mm.
That was really considered a Protestant sort of a – you know, that still clung to it. So there wasn't a lot of imbibing.
And
right.
and it did seem from your notes, she mm-hmm. wanted a well-set table. So that was as important
right.
then as it is today?
Yes, absolutely. Women took great pride in having an absolutely stark white tablecloth. And the men were also – it was considered an honor to have for the husband to have a big family all around. So you invited your parents and the relatives, and everybody came. And so imagine how much time it took to prepare for something like that. Stains weren't easily gotten out of cloth, and somebody's always spilling plum wine or tar or something on your beautiful cloth. And so it was a lot of work.
Well, just thinking of the logistics of preparing all that food, and even if your sister-in-law brought the roast bear, you
really?
Still had a lot of work to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Without all of the amenities that we just take for granted, like throw it in the freezer mm-hmm. or pre-make mm-hmm. it and then bring it to, you know, to reheat it.
Well, it was a big deal, and all done on a fireplace, not to forget. So, yeah.
So for those of us who are kind of moaning a little bit about what we have to do, be grateful might we have a double oven or we have the range tops and we have our refrigerators. And
right. One thing I didn't see is mashed potatoes. Very few potatoes. You said in Ireland they had them. They did stuff ducks with potatoes, but you don't see mashed potatoes as a big thing.
But sweet potatoes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sweet potatoes, definitely.
Big.
Yeah.
So it does sound pretty much like we would be able to step back, or they could come up and join us, and we'd all get along. What are you having for your Thanksgiving dinner?
We're having bear. Yeah, no, I think we'll probably have turkey. Roast turkey, not boiled.
Bill, a lot of fun, as always, talking with you. Bill Loomis, who is the author of Detroit's Delectable Past, 2 centuries of frog legs, pigeon pie, and drugstore whiskey. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, Cindy.
One of my cherished Thanksgiving Day memories goes back to 1959, having my dad bundle me up and take me from our home in Ferndale, down Woodward Avenue, where he positioned us right across from the giant flag on the Hudson Building. And there we watched the Thanksgiving Day parade, made extra special for me by the fact that Sherry Lewis and her puppet Lamb Chop were the grand marshals. How many of you have lined Woodward Avenue over the decades to watch the parade and see the mayor give the key to the city of Detroit and the collective hearts of its kids to Santa? We wanted to look at the history of Detroit's venerable Thanksgiving Day parade, so we turned to Romy Miner. He's a librarian and archivist at the Detroit Public Library. He wrote a book about the Detroit parade called Detroit's Thanksgiving Day Parade, co-authored with his wife, Lorianne Tamburino. Welcome, Romy.
Glad to be here.
So tell us, when did the first parade happen in Detroit?
It started in 1924. Charles Wendell, who was the display manager at J.O. Hudson's, had seen a parade at Eaton's department store in Toronto right before Christmas, and he thought this would be a really an effective marketing tool to promote Christmas. So the next year, in 1924, he just thought about having this parade with Santa to promote J.O. Hudson's and start off Christmas. So the first parade in 1924 only lasted 1 hour. That was it. Right down the street started 2nd Avenue, right around Grand Circus Park, and then went down Woodward to Hudson's, but it only lasted 1 hour.
Now, on the national scale, Romy, Detroit's parade really is a heavy hitter, isn't it?
Yes. It's still the third largest parade in the country, followed by the Rose Parade and Macy's. And it's just a part of Detroit history now, along with the Detroit Lions, which started in the mid-30s, and it's become a tradition throughout Michigan and the Midwest.
But the parade's fortunes have gone up and down through the years. Now, clearly, you know, there's no longer a Hudson's, but even before Hudson's went away, did it not stop being Hudson's Parade?
Yes, it had various names over the years. From the when it started out, was the annual Children's Parade. It was the Christmas Parade. Then it was the Hudson's Toyland Parade. Hudson's basically stopped sole sponsorship probably around the late 1970s. Mm. And then in the early 80s, the Detroit Renaissance took over the parade because it was having a lot of financial problems.
I remember that.
And then right around 1982, you had the Michigan Parade Foundation, which was set up by civic leaders. It was headed by then Paula Blanchard, First Lady of Michigan at the time, to keep the parade going. And since then, you have the parade company, which is a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of the Michigan Parade Foundation, which has been putting on the Thanksgiving Day Parade since then.
Was it ever in risk of being extinguished the way the state fair has? Was it very close to being extinguished?
Yes, and with the help of a lot of donations, including Art Van. There were several times, yes, that it was just not going to be around. And because of the outpouring from these corporations and civic leaders, they were able to keep it going on. Now, most of the floats that you see are sponsored. So we do have that to keep it going now. So it's totally different than when Hudson's just was the main person.
Sure.
It was Hudson's employees. So now you have that sponsorship, which does keep that going.
There is something good and, I guess, dare I say, reassuring to know that a tradition that goes back to 1924 still continues. So as people line up on Woodward tomorrow morning, it will they'll be following in a lot of footsteps through many, many years.
It's great because I've been the archivist for the parade company for 13 years now, and I've organized all their photos. And when you go through the photos over the years, doesn't matter, you see that look of awe on all these children's faces. You see their parents either holding them up, looking at the floats. You see their faces. And it doesn't matter which decade. It doesn't matter what year. The face expression remains the same, and it's just great. And it'll be that way tomorrow when you have a million plus people on that route. And it's just great because it is a part of Detroit's history, Michigan history, and basically American history for this Thanksgiving parade here in Detroit.
Romy Miner is a librarian at the Detroit Public Library, and he is the archivist for the Parade Company, author of the book Detroit's Thanksgiving Parade. Romy, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Cynthia.
America's Thanksgiving Parade continues its 86-year tradition tomorrow morning. It'll step off at 9:05 a.m. at Woodward and Mack, and we've put some historic photos from America's Thanksgiving Parade up on our website at michiganradio.org. Coming up, Michigan writer and poet Keith Taylor stops by to talk about his favorite cold weather books by Michigan authors. That's next here on Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk books. Sure, lots of people talk about reading on the beach in summertime, and they say they make sure to tuck a book into the beach bag. But some of us feel that the very best time to curl up with a book is late fall and winter. Come on, who can resist a fireplace, a cup of something warm, and a good book as the temperature slides south? So with that in mind, we thought we'd get some suggestions for your cold weather reading list and help you discover or revisit some Michigan authors. So for that expert guidance, we turn to poet and writer Keith Taylor. He coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan, and he directs the Bear River Writers Conference, and he's the poetry editor for Michigan Quarterly Review, and he joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Do you think I have something up there that there's just a magical time about reading in the winter and, you know, the fireplace might be on? And
absolutely. And I was thinking this time people reading on an electronic reader in front of a fake screen fireplace, drinking Red Bull or something. The world may have changed, but the aesthetic stays the same.
We still love to fall into good book. So we asked you to pick some good suggestions for our wintertime reading. So what have you brought us?
Well, I brought three books, and I was thinking, you know, people have different tastes for winter reading. I think there are many people who want to go to someplace far away and exotic with palm trees and warm winter breezes. And then there are the others who just want to disappear in big stories.
Yes,
this winter after the movie, how many people are going to read or reread Anna Karenina?
Yes.
And they'll disappear for a month.
Absolutely.
6 weeks. You know, they'll come back and their family will look like foreigners. I have to admit, since I'm, you know, a northerner and in cold weather, I like to read about cold. And I like to read about snow. And Michigan authors, not surprisingly, have been good about writing about snow and cold and winter. I thought about, you know, Jim Harrison, of course. But Jim Harrison, well, you know, he gets a lot of attention. And he doesn't need our help. People are going to read him anyway, although he writes wonderfully about winter in many of his books and in many of his poems.
Sure.
So I picked three, you know, varying reputations.
Okay.
The first one I want to talk about is a guy named John Smolens, who teaches up at Northern Michigan University.
So he knows about winter.
He knows about winter. He knows. And he writes about winter almost all the time. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about a book of his called Cold and give you a sample of it.
Yes,
please.
Seems
like a good place to start,
right?
Let's
do it.
A novel called Cold. You might call it a crime novel, although I think, you know, the crimes are kind of off stage and they're kind of subdued. So it's a little bit different than a crime novel. It starts out a woman living alone in the woods, a potter living alone in the woods. Her husband and daughter have died in a terrible car accident on a snowy road. And she's living way off by herself, and she looks out her window in a blizzard just as night is falling, and she sees a man standing alone at the edge of the forest.
Okay.
She's not terrified. She pulls out her husband's gun and invites the man in. and thus begins the story, which goes on. And it's a complicated story. And, of course, when you talk about these books, you never want to give too much of
it. No, you don't.
Ruin things for people. But he's an escaped prisoner. He's walked away from – he's a trustee who's walked away in a blizzard from Marquette Prison. And he's going to find his family and maybe try to either escape or clear himself. You know, if you're walking away in the UP, you're thinking you're going to go to Canada, which, of course, is where everybody's going to look for him. he does get together with his former lover. And as she's thinking about where they're going to go, she says kind of in a nice way, how hard it is to get out of Michigan. It's big and surrounded mostly by water. So it's like they're stuck. They're stuck in the UP. But there are some wonderful descriptions of winter. And as the plot unfolds, they move around. Here they go to a – I just want to read you a little paragraph where they go to a lodge up in the – up north of Marquette, up toward the Huron Mountains up there in central UP. The snow continues to fall. The snow falls throughout this book. It falls constantly in this book, which I love. So here's when they arrive. When they reached the trees, they could see the lodge, a long log cabin with a steep pitched roof. Below the lodge, a narrow river wound through marshlands, snow covered in most places, though at one bend the ice had given way, revealing black water. On the far side of the river stood a wall of birch and pines, their branches heavy with snow. The ridge commanded a view of steep, forested hills in every direction, except several miles to the east, where the broad blue plain of Lake Superior seemed to rise up to meet the sky.
Gorgeous.
So, yeah, the winter.
Gorgeous.
You know, Smolin's, I mean, he writes about winter. Another one of his books is called Winter by Degrees, which I recommend. So it's, you know, but again, that's got to be the kind of personality that's sitting inside by that warm fire.
Yes.
Wants to read about the cold. And I'm that personality. It sounds like you might be.
I am too. That sounds very, very good.
It's from 2001.
Yeah.
It's in paperback now. It's still available.
Okay.
And it's a good read.
It's a good read. So John Smolin's Cold is our first one.
Yep.
Next up.
Is a crime writer named Steve Hamilton. Have you run across him?
No, I have not.
Oh, he's fascinating. He actually lives in upstate New York. He writes, he was a student at U of M back in the day, won Hopwood Awards here. And he's gone off and he's been a professional writer for, one of those big companies up there in upstate New York. But he started this crime writing series. It all takes place in the eastern Upper Peninsula. He has a wonderful detective named Alex McKnight. Alex McKnight is a Detroit cop who got shot in the line of duty and has a bullet lodged in by his heart. So he's got to get away from Detroit or he's got to quit work and he gets away. And where does he go? He buys a cabin on Whitefish Point. Up just north of the little town of Paradise. And he's going to live his life out there. And he's not going to be bothered by things.
But
of course, once a cop, always a cop. The crimes seem to follow him. Steve's done several of these books now. If you get a chance to talk to him sometime, I think you should. He's a wonderful
And
player.
Alex McKnight is his...
Alex McKnight appears in almost all of his books.
But you can pick one. They're not a series.
Independent.
There you go.
The one I want to talk about is the first one, where he invented the character. And this is, I think the book was originally published in 98 or 99. It's called A Cold Day in Paradise. There can't be any listeners who don't know that we have a Paradise, Michigan. But if there are, they should go check it out. It's a wonderful little town way up there. So Alex McKnight is up there, and he's basically become a curmudgeon. He goes into town to have his Canadian beers and talk to the bartender all through winter. But interestingly enough, the crimes he's working on in Detroit start following him, and he can't quite figure it out. Somebody is trying to recreate the things he worked on in the city in the eastern UP. The book, A Cold Day in Paradise, works through this as he's trying to figure out why this is and what's happening. So like a crime writer, it's most like all good crime writers, it's mostly character plot and character driven.
Okay.
You don't – when there is sort of landscape touches, they're just quick little brush strokes. You don't spend a lot of time dealing with that. And of course, dialogue. The dialogue's great. And the Michigan crime writers have been great. Steve won an Edgar Award for this book, which is the award, Best First Novel, which is the big award given for crime writing. you know, our famous Elmore Leonard, of course, is, and he's famous for the way he makes people talk.
His dialogue.
That's amazing.
Can you give us a sample?
Absolutely.
Go
Although
ahead.
The piece I have is not dialogue.
Okay.
The piece I have is just a little bit of these brush strokes, and it gives you a little sense. Again, got to find a place that can give you this and is not going to give away too much of the plot, because I do want people to read this book. This is a wonderful winter read. Starts in October, moves through Halloween, up into Thanksgiving, and into the edge of winter.
Right now is the time
right
to read this book,
this
isn't
is,
it?
This is the gray Michigan early winter, late fall. So this is Steve Hamilton. At the window, I could see that the rain had let up into a steady drizzle, but the wind was still howling, and it kept whipping up the surface of the lake. I could see the waves crashing on the rocky shoreline below the house. It wasn't even a lake anymore, not on a day like this. It was a sea, the kind of sea that wrecks ships and pulls men to their deaths. And now Edwin was out there, somewhere at the bottom of all that cold water.
I love it. Okay, I'm not familiar with him, but I'm going to get
He's a lot of fun. And when I knew I was going to talk about this book, I was looking for all my Steve Hamilton, and I realized I'd given them all away. So I had to go out and find another copy of the book. So, and I don't give my books away. I covet my books. You know? I fill my house with them.
I understand that. So that's Steve Hamilton, and that particular one was called
A Cold Day in Paradise.
All right.
And he's got another one since then. But the last one I read was one called Misery Bay, which is about a bay over where the Keweenaw Peninsula comes down. And it's needless to say, there's a body hanging from a tree. That's how the novel starts.
Sounds like there should be somebody smart jumping on these for movie options.
And I bet you I would be willing to bet that that's going to happen.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That good.
And with mysteries, when they have all that great dialogue, it's so easy to adapt them to movies, because these writers think of them in these terms of scene and people talking. And it's why Elmore Leonard's books have made such great movies.
Yes.
Yeah, and they really have.
Now we move on.
Well, this one's a little bit different. This one's gotten a little more attention recently. This is Bonnie Jo Campbell's most recent novel, called Once Upon a River.
And tell us a little about Bonnie Jo.
Bonnie Jo, isn't Bonnie Jo great? Bonnie Jo has done a lot of things over the years. She grew up in rural southwestern Michigan, I think on the banks of the St. Joe River, actually. She was the smart girl, of course, and she'd never tell you this herself. Mm-hmm. I hope you get to interview her sometime soon.
So you can brag on her.
She went off to the University of Chicago and did a degree in philosophy. Big, prestigious university, difficult degree.
Yeah.
She did it. She came back to Michigan. She was going to do a PhD in mathematics at Western. While there, she decided that she had to take a break from, you know, PhD in mathematics. I can't even imagine what that must be
like. I can't either. So she took a break
She took a break from her PhD, and she took a writing class with the novelist Jamie Gordon, who won the National Book Award last year, is also a wonderful writer. And she got hooked with writing. And Jamie, of course, recognized her brilliance right away. So Bonnie Jo dropped her PhD and did a Master of Fine Arts in fiction. So Once Upon a River is a kind of – it takes place, I think, in the early 80s on a fictional river that's a tributary of the Kalamazoo River.
Okay.
I was talking to her about this a year or so ago, and I said, why the early 80s? And she said, I wanted a time that seemed contemporary but was just before cell phones.
Very good.
So not all – she didn't want the characters distracted by all that stuff.
And it lets you, I'm sure, as a writer, develop things in a maybe a purer way where one cell phone call could blow the whole
thing. Exactly. And these are about poor people.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, everybody's got cell phones now. I mean, all over the world.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, should I buy food or a cell phone? Oh,
mm-hmm,
I'll buy a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't want that distraction, because she wanted to – and you can see from the title, Once Upon a River, it has that sort of fairy tale feel to it, once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
And a river, of course, in America, what do we think of? We think of Huck Finn. We think of all the great On the Road novels. She connects with that. So she creates this kind of American myth. She has a great character, female character named Margot Crane.
Young girl.
Starts out very young. Yes, yes. You've read this book.
I'm actually in the middle of it.
Are you really? Good
I
for
am.
You.
I didn't
Good
know you were going to bring this
That's
one
right.
up.
That's right. It almost seems as if we planned it.
Yes.
But, and she starts out quite young. I mean, I think she's 16. Her father ends up dead. She ends up hiding from the people on the river. She moves up and down this river. And again, you don't want to give too much
away.
No.
But
she's a strong character, very much her own person, very self-contained. So she moves up and down. She has some lovers. She has people who take care of her. She gets out again. And the interesting thing about this book, although it covers several years, it moves toward winter. Now, you're not there yet.
No.
But the resolution of this book is in winter.
Okay.
On Kalamazoo, on a very cold and
right.
and drizzly, snowy, ice-filled Kalamazoo River. And it's really interesting that Bonnie Jo goes there and where she gets to in this place. It's a little – I try to pick a place.
Yes.
It's not going to give away plot item,
yes.
ideas. But this is right at the end of the book. And
okay.
This is
but
after,
no spoiler alerts here because
no,
you don't
no
believe
spoiler
in
alerts. No spoiler alerts. I don't need to give them because
no.
you're the major information you're not going to get.
Okay.
But so this girl has worked hard. She's had a tough life.
Mm-hmm.
She's moved through this Michigan landscape. She's moved through our battered economy. She's moved through our small town. She's had people disdain her. She's been abandoned by her mother, but she's found a way to live, and she's found a small, very small group of friends. She's down. She's on the Kalamazoo River. Some terrible things have happened, and she's wandering back to her home. What's her home now? In a snowstorm, and she stumbles. She stumbles in the snow in a field. She pressed her cheek against the snow, felt the snow compress and melt slightly. Snow began to accumulate on her other cheek. She would lie there for a moment until she was rested, until she understood what had happened this morning and what had happened in her life. Her obligations had been met, and she was free, more free than she had ever been. Within minutes, she was hardly feeling the cold. If she could return to her boat, she would start a fire to thaw herself out, or else she would remain right here, at rest. So it's a little bit scary, of course. You know, the snow is there. The snow is, what does that rest lying in the snow mean? Well, we know what it means.
Yeah,
you know, she's not going to get up.
Forever, yes.
Right. But on the other hand, this girl's been through a lot.
It's earthy and gritty, the part where I'm at this point.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a very earthy and very gritty.
Very gritty book. It is indeed. It's fun to teach this book to undergraduates. They all sort of raise their eyebrows. It's like, whoa. And you didn't think, 20-year-olds could be shocked. But, interestingly enough, you can still shock them with a book.
I can only imagine some of your finicky germaphobe young ladies, because my daughter and her friends would be among them going, oh, she did what?
She did that?
To that deer? No.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
This is a young lady who is at home in the woods and
Absolutely.
At home with nature in a way that I bet it's a real revelation for kids today.
It is. And it is indeed. And the fact that and they sometimes are a little bit skeptical about this.
Yeah.
And they don't quite realize that people can and do actually still live like this in our state.
Closer
to the world, still depend on wild food. This is real people doing real things.
Huh.
And it's interesting that Bonnie Jo's affections are so clearly with these people.
Yeah.
And I think that's the strength of her book, and that's what makes the stuff interesting, because she really cares about these people, and she knows our landscape. The class that I teach this book in is a class on environmental writing.
Oh.
So I use this book as an example of landscape writing and environment writing, even though it's got a rich character and really a really fascinating storyline.
And this book, again, is Bonnie Jo Campbell.
Once Upon a River.
These are all Michigan writers who have found different paths to pursue what's inside of them and are successful at it.
They are, yeah. All of these people are doing quite well. Steve and Bonnie Jo, I think, are both living off their writing now. John still has a day job at the university. But they're three examples of fiction writers, in our state right now doing things using the state. And we have a lot. I mean, we have a rich writing culture in our state. And there's a lot of people to talk to. And there's a lot of people who've written about who fit my definition of a good winter read. But these were the three that first occurred to me when you asked me to talk about this. And I'm very fond of all of them.
Writer and poet Keith Taylor, thank you for sharing your winter reading list with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we will put links to all of these books on our webpage at michiganradio.org. Here at Stateside, we love hearing from you, and it's easy to get in touch with us. Go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. That's Canty. And on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Happy, happy Thanksgiving Day to you and yours, and we'll be back with you at 3 o'clock on Monday.